Welcome, everybody. It is a pleasure to have today for this seminar a colleague, Eli Gateva, Dr. Eli Gateva, who is a visiting fellow here at LISI, the LSE Research Unit on Southeast Europe, as you probably already know. Eli is really an expert on EU conditionality, accession, and she works on dimensions of Europeanization and democratic governance. She has been, previous to coming here, she was in Queen Mary, and before that she had a lectureship in the Department of Politics in Manchester, where she also finished her PhD, I think. Yes, correct information. her work, as I said, concerns EU conditionality, but she looks in particular at the recent the development of conditionality as a process in the different waves of enlargement 2007-2013, and the conditionality currently in the Western Balkans. And her recent publication deals with this issue. Just last year she published a book, European Union Enlargement Conditionality, with Patrick Macmillan. And her work here at the LISI shifts a bit the focus, or maintains the focus, but also extends it to post-accession conditionality in places like Greece and other, perhaps other bailout countries. And I think this is the topic of some of the material that she will talk about, the cooperation verification mechanism in Eastern Balkans and the task force in Greece in particular. Before I give the floor to Eli, I should just say that our next events, because I will forget at the end, our next event is in 2 weeks' time, Tuesday, 16th of February. We're looking at fiscal decentralization and local government financing in Serbia and Montenegro, in the same venue here. And then on the 3rd of March, we have a film screening in the Thai Theatre, new academic building, a bit further up the streets, with screening The Agreement, a kind of documentary on the Belgrade-Pristina dialogue, and it will be followed by a panel discussion. 3rd of March, new academic building. Okay, other events as well, you can see further down the line. So I'll stop here and I'll pass the floor to Eli, who's going to talk to us about post-accession conditionality monitoring without punishment.
Thank you, Vasilis. Yes, what I would like to tell you more about is the development of the cooperation verification mechanism and its implications, its effectiveness, and some of the issues that have emerged in the literature on Europeanization and conditionality. Well, first I would like to tell you briefly a little bit more about the cooperation and verification mechanism. Some of you who are Bulgarian or Romanian have been following the issue very closely will know that it was set up on the 1st of January 2007. So when Bulgaria and Romania joined the European Union, the cooperation and verification mechanism was set up in order to follow, monitor progress in the areas of judicial reform, fight against organized crime, and only in the case of Bulgaria, fight against organized crime, and in both cases, fight against corruption. What makes it interesting is the fact that it is in its 10th year now, even though most of the Commission officials would not have expected the mechanism to last for that long, as it was intended to address some remaining weaknesses in those areas. Furthermore, it's only applicable to two member states, so we have only Bulgaria and Romania. We can see Croatia joined in 2013, and even though there was quite a lot of speculation about it, and Germany was very keen to see similar monitoring instrument put in place for Croatia, this did not happen. The Commission, and particularly DG Enlargement, stressed very firmly that this was a one-off event, never to be repeated again. Some of the issues that arise from the cooperation and verification mechanism is the fact that it is based on very thin acquis with areas where there is very little hard law, so that's why it's open to various interpretations. Another issue that has emerged is the fact that the mechanism is open-ended. The question is, we have now a commitment from the new president of the Commission that the mechanism should be scrapped by the end of the term of this commission, which means that it should be scrapped by 2019. I mean, again, many have questioned the legitimacy of the instrument. Questions have been raised about discriminatory nature of the mechanism, because we have only Bulgaria and Romania being monitored in areas such as corruption, given the fact that similar problems we have seen in other member states, such as Greece and Italy. What is another interesting dimension of the mechanism is that we can see some important implications for the development of a range of internal and external EU policies, particularly in the new approach towards enlargement with the Western Balkans and Turkey. So I would like to just outline some of the key features of the cooperation and verification mechanism. The legal basis, we can find them in the accession treaty with Bulgaria and Romania. What was interesting about the accession treaty is that, unlike the treaty which was signed with the other 10 countries that joined in 2004, we can see that there was, for the very first time, the super safeguard clause was included in the accession treaty, which allowed for the postponement of the accession negotiation with Bulgaria and Romania by 1 year. So if there were insufficient progress in particular areas, the Commission could have decided to postpone the accession to let them join on the 1st of January 2008. The case of Romania is slightly more interesting, because not only was there the postponement or the super safeguard clause, but also we can see that there was an additional protocol that included 11 benchmarks, which 7 of them were in the area of judicial reform and 5 of them were in the competition policy chapter. So those conditions were to be very closely monitored, but unlike the safeguard clause that was applicable in the case of Bulgaria, in the case of Romania, the member states could vote to invoke this clause, and it didn't need to have unanimous decisions, so qualified majority was enough in this case to activate the clauses. Clearly, what has happened is the first decision to be made whether Bulgaria and Romania should join on the 1st of January 2007 or 1st of January 2008 was to be made in May 2006. There was a comprehensive monitoring report published in May. However, the Commission decided to postpone its decision because it needed further confirmation about the progress that has taken place in Bulgaria and Romania. So what happened in September 2006, and I mean, I just want to remind you of the framework. Bulgaria and Romania joined in January. This was mid-September, so less than 4 months before the accession of the countries, the decision was made that Bulgaria and Romania will be allowed to join and they're sufficiently prepared to become members of the European Union. However, weaknesses in the area of judicial reform, fight against corruption and organized crime justified the establishment of the cooperation and verification mechanism, which was envisaged as an ad hoc solution in order to monitor progress in those areas. What we can see is that there were two different sets of benchmarks were set up for Bulgaria and for Romania. What the mechanism was linked to, had the countries failed to progress sufficiently in those two areas, was the activation of another safeguard clause which was included in the accession treaty. That was the Justice and Home Affairs Safeguard Clause. So that was the sanction that was linked to the existing mechanism. What happened is the way that you don't, I mean, I'm aware that probably you cannot read all the letters over there. Just what I want to do is to illustrate my way of trying to organize some of the key analytical points that I would like to make is to think of EU conditionality. There is no commonly agreed definition, but the way that I have put together a classification that allows us to study the evolution of conditionality is by looking at different stages. So we have pre-accession, we have negotiation, we have accession, and post-accession stage, and what I focus on are three key dimensions. So obviously conditions are incredibly important because those are the set of rules or the demands that the European Union has put up. And also we have an incentive structure. So basically the instruments which the European Commission and the European Union have in order to make candidate countries comply with its demands, and we can talk about and think about rewards and threats. And also another element which I believe is very important is monitoring, because in most cases, particularly in post-accession conditionality, we have seen that the monitoring reports have provided the basis for further clarifying and enhancing the scope of the conditions. What is interesting, so just to clarify that I would focus and we'll talk more about these three key elements: the conditions, the incentive structure, and the monitoring. And if you have any more questions, I will happily take them after the presentation. So at this stage, I will not go into any further details, but basically what I do is I focus on the different stages, look at the conditions, incentive structure, and monitoring. And I mean, again, these were the six benchmarks that were initially set out for Bulgaria. You could argue, as some of the Bulgarian politicians at that time did, that some of them were very vague. For example, if you look at benchmark number 3, continue the reform of the judiciary in order to enhance professionalism, accountability, and efficiency. Number 5, take further measures to prevent and fight corruption. And number 6, implement a strategy to fight organized crime, focusing on serious crime, report on new and ongoing investigations. I mean, again, if we look at number 2, similar developments we could argue there, ensure a more transparent and efficient judicial process. Probably only the first benchmark has been a little bit more specific compared to the other benchmarks. So those were the 6 initial benchmarks that were set up for Bulgaria. Romania, there were only 4 benchmarks, and we can see here they're slightly more positive compared to the Bulgarian ones. Here we can see benchmark number 3, for example. The European Commission is talking about building on progress already made, continue to conduct professional, non-partisan investigations into allegations of high-level corruption. I mean, again, take further measures to prevent and fight corruption, establish an integrity agency, and I will talk more about the integrity agency later. But here, I mean, again, we can see that even at this stage, there is a clear vision how to deal with improving the efficiency of the judiciary. And I mean, again, similar number 1 is also similar to the benchmarks that we have seen for Bulgaria, ensure more transparent and efficient judicial process. So it's interesting that, I mean, again, in the case of Romania, less benchmarks because the progress was deemed that they have covered more areas compared to Bulgaria, and we do not have benchmarks for organized crime. I would like to talk a little bit more now about the incentives that the European Union has put in place. Obviously, once the countries were allowed to become members of the European Union, there aren't any new incentives along the way of accession, and the European Commission relied on sanctions or threats in order to make sure that the new countries that have just been accepted comply with its demands and ensure sustainable progress in those areas. Probably 2008, I mean, there are 2 very interesting years if we look at sanctioning lack of sufficient progress. 2008 was very interesting because this was the most critical report issued in the case of Bulgaria. Then, however, the Commission decided that support is more effective than sanctions and it will not invoke the safeguard provisions set in the accession treaty. There are a number of reasons why the safeguard clause was not invoked. Some of the key issues and problems with the safeguard clause were, I mean, I have a few very nice quotes from my interviews when I was in Brussels. In 2009, the debate about the early developments of the mechanism was still very important for the further evolution of the mechanism. And clearly there is this appreciation that this continuing cooperation in the area of justice and home affairs will do absolutely nothing in terms of improving the situation in Bulgaria. Also, somebody said that compared to political exposure, the safeguard is a Mickey Mouse clause. And we have seen that another important issue and implication at that point of time was the credibility of the European Commission and the credibility of the European Union, and noted that the disadvantages of activating outweighed the advantages. So essentially what we can have here, to briefly summarize it, that we have a sanctioning threat that had very little substance. First of all, absolutely no point in activating it, and second of all, very little would have changed in addition to compromising the position of the European Commission and the European Union for letting those countries join in. And nevertheless, it's very interesting to say that some member states, particularly the Netherlands, was very keen to push for the activation of the safeguard clause. Also, it's very interesting to point out that the then Minister of EU Affairs in the Netherlands happens to be the now first Vice President of the European Commission. So Frans Timmermans sent a letter to Barroso demanding the activation of the Justice and Home Affairs clause. Anyway, the decision was made that it will not be activated. Nevertheless, in 2008, what the Commission did is, in addition to publishing the reports on the lack of progress in Bulgaria, it did publish an additional report which was monitoring the management of European funds and concluded that Bulgaria will lose, because of mismanagement, close to 420 million euros. So although it was completely outside of the framework of the cooperation verification mechanism, symbolically, the European Commission decided not only to release these reports in the same date, to publish them on the same website, and to make a strong and important link that lack or following issues in terms of fight against corruption and organized crime, which has led to mismanagement of European funds and lack of efficiency prosecuting them, will be sanctioned at this point of time. The reaction of the then Prime Minister was also a very interesting one. Bulgaria, which still remains to be the poorest member of the European Union, he said that the money will be compensated from the national budget. So all the projects that have started would continue and will be financed by the existing budget. It's also very interesting that at this point of time, the Bulgarian Prime Minister asked the European Commission to send experts in order to fix this issue, and Barroso was very firm in his point that this was not going to happen. So experts will continue working with national experts, but they were not going to be put in place to substitute Bulgarian authorities. Another interesting development that we also need to consider is that all the safeguard clauses that were included in the accession treaty expired, but they were put there for a period of 3 years. So essentially on the 1st of January, this Justice and Home Affairs clause, which we've mentioned before, that had absolutely no teeth in the first place, could not be invoked anymore. So in 2009, in the summer, when I was in Brussels, there was a big debate what to do, whether we should introduce a new sanctions, how should we deal with this issue. If we don't have any other sanctions, how are we just going to continue monitoring and registering the lack of progress? The big debate was whether to link progress in the area of cooperation and verification mechanism with entry to the Schengen area. It's very interesting, though, that although that was the idea, member states decided not to make this link official because some member states believe that they will give Bulgaria and Romania an easy ride to entering Schengen by saying that progress in those areas is enough to make sure that they become members of the travel, the passport free area. So what happened is there was no official link made. However, we can see all the Bulgaria and Romania comply with the Schengen acquis in 2011. For the last 5 years now, we have a configuration of different member states who have been blocking the accession of Bulgaria and Romania to Schengen area. It is usually either, it was Netherlands, Germany, Finland, and France. They have taken turns. Some have lifted their vetoes. Some of them have vetoed it again. More interesting, actually, it is that now the debate is still firmly on the agenda, and Romanians have raised again this issue and say that good progress and good compliance should mean that now they should join the Schengen area, despite the uncertain future of this area in the first place right now. So this has illegitimately been linked to the entrance of Schengen area. What we can see with the third aspect when we talk about monitoring When the mechanism was set up in the first place, the Commission decided that reports will be presented at least every 6 months. It was quite an unusual development, because we can see that all the enlargement progress reports published on annual basis. In this case, we have seen reports published every 6 months. In 2012, there were some expectations that 5 years after the mechanism was launched, an overall assessment exercise will provide or will register sufficient evidence to discontinue this mechanism. Unfortunately, the publication of reports coincided with the political crisis in Romania. So not only the mechanism was not discontinued, but we have seen enhanced monitoring put in place in the case of Romania, additional set of conditions in the areas of rule of law, but also the freedom of media has been put in place, and swift action has been asked of Romanian authorities. The then Prime Minister of Romania, Victor Ponta, was summoned to Brussels, and Barroso gave a very firm speech saying that our trust has been shaken. We have seen that since then the situation has improved dramatically in Romania. On this note, it's also interesting to know that the number of reports which have been published for both Bulgaria and Romania during their preparation for membership, the number is 9 so far. We have 14 reports for Bulgaria and 15 reports for Romania. The difference is the emergency report, which was envisaged in 2012, was published in January 2013. There was only one report published for Romania. And basically, we can see that since January 2014, the Commission has gone back to reporting on annual basis. What is interesting to see that initially, the philosophy of the mechanism was that both countries will tick off benchmarks. So what is going to happen? 6 months, we'll tick off one benchmark. After that, we'll tick off another benchmark. When all the benchmarks have been completed, the mechanism will be discontinued. In 2009, the Commission confirmed that its approach has changed, and that all benchmarks are closely interlinked, which means that the mechanism will stay in place, no benchmarks will be ticked off, but when all the areas and all demands have been met, then the mechanism will be discontinued. It's even more interesting to see that in 2013 we have seen that there was this realization that it's going to take quite a long time to actually deal with those very serious issues, and the initial expectations that 3 years, which coincided with the length of the safeguard clauses included in the accession treaties, will be enough to deal with those substantial reforms. So since then, we have the understanding that it's not realistic to expect quick results. What we have seen, I don't want to go through all the reports. The exciting news is that we have last Wednesday the Commission published the latest sets of reports, and I want to highlight only some of the findings in both cases. What we have seen in the case of Bulgaria, it's not particularly promising. The Commission has used data from the European Court of Human Rights, basically noting that there are 45 judgments against Bulgaria found that the authorities had failed to comply with their obligations to carry out an effective investigation, and considered that this recurrent shortcomings disclosed the existence of a systemic problem. Another area which has been closely monitored for more than 9 years. The need for deeper reform of the prosecution is borne out by the continued lack of a solid track record in high-level cases on corruption and organized crime. Bulgaria consistently ranks among the EU member states with the highest perceived level of corruption. Interestingly enough, last Wednesday, also Transparency International published their reports on perception of corruption. And indeed, Bulgaria was crowned as the king of corruption, taking the 69th place. It's some of the candidate countries did even better. What we have seen is, this is another interesting remark, institutions which have been set up to fight corruption have been characterized as fragmented and uncoordinated. So there have been, I mean, I don't want to sound very incredibly pessimistic, the Commission has also noticed two positive trends, that for the very first time we have a comprehensive strategy for judicial reform, and we also have a strategy that has been put in place to fight corruption and organized crime. So these are some of the positives, but I wanted to draw attention to the lack of solid track record. Now, I just want to show you the case of Romania. What we read from the latest reports, the Commission praises the achievements in Romania, saying that the track record of key judicial and integrity institutions to address high-level corruption has remained impressive. We have also a lot of words of praise for the judicial system. They say that it has continued to show its professionalism, willing capacity to adapt to significant changes. The civil criminal courts have also done a very good job. And essentially, there is a strong willingness to defend the independence of judiciary. And they have provided evidence for some of the solid track record that Romanians have been establishing over the last 2 or 3 years. We have seen that the DNA, this is the National Directorate, so the National Anti-Corruption Directorate, are basically some of the high cases that they have dealt with include former Prime Minister, former ministers, members of parliaments, mayors, presidents of the country councils, judges, prosecutors, and a wide variety senior officials. I mean, again, it's impressive that the total number of officials sent to trial for corruption amount to almost 100 mayors, and we have over 20 county councils. I think that the number of county councils in Romania is 42, so 20 of them. And we, I mean, again, a number of local officials, and a very important case was also the former mayor of Bucharest, was also taken to trial. So in contrast, I mean, there are problems here as well. Not to sound too optimistic, here the Commission has also noted some important problems, that interference politicians, particularly members of parliament, that have tried to basically block the work of the two agencies, the Anti-Corruption Agency and the Integrity Agency. There have been issues in terms of lifting the immunity of members of parliament, and I think that one third of the cases that the DNA had tried to raise have been blocked. So there is still interference over the independence of judiciary. Nevertheless, over the last 3 years, Romania has been set on a quite impressive track record, and the Commission is looking forward to see those results. The argument here is that they're close to a consolidation phase in terms of achieving their track record, in contrast with Bulgaria, where we are not even talking about implementation. We are at the early stages of trying with a comprehensive solution or legislative base in order to build on these developments. The question about effectiveness, how effective and successful this mechanism has been widely debated, both by practitioners, members of parliament, but also by academics. There are a number of problems trying to evaluate the effectiveness of the mechanism. I will just give you some of the observations that we can see from the European Commission and from some leading Romanians. So here we can see that the chief prosecutor of the National Anti-Corruption Directorate have noted, this is from April 2015, without this mechanism, the reform of the judiciary would have never had such a scale. Monica Macovei, who used to be the Minister of Justice in Romania, noted that this mechanism is highly efficient. If it didn't exist, the National Directorate for the Fight Against Corruption would not have existed in Romania, an institution with huge success, which works very well. Interestingly enough, the Commission also noted in January that the CVM continues to play an important role in Romania as a driver for reform and an incentive to maintain consistency in track record. So it's not surprising here, you can see that the Romanians are quite positive about the emergence of this mechanism. I have not included on this slide the quotes from Bulgarian members of the European Parliament. They have said that it doesn't work, so that's why it should be discontinued. There is no track record of any sustainable change, so that's why it should be discontinued. Some of the other arguments include the fact that corruption is a widespread EU issue, so why have only Bulgaria and Romania being so rigorously monitored under this mechanism? Trying to establish clear benchmarks about what should we consider success and what we should not consider a success, it's a very interesting issue, and I think it's important to be revisited, because for the first 5 years, and I mean again most of the articles that have been published look at the period from 2007 to 2012, and we can see that clearly at this point of time there is very little in terms of sustainable track records. So most of the colleagues were very skeptical about the success of this instrument. I have highlighted some of the key limitations of the institutional base of the mechanism and the lack of tangible results back then in both countries. However, we can see now that there is a very interesting picture has been developing over the last 3 years. We have Romania, where reforms have been taking root, as the Commission would like to say. And in the case of Bulgaria, another exercise of trying to come up with a comprehensive strategy how to deal with those problems. So that's why it's very interesting to see what can account for this differentiation in terms of outcomes that have been produced in the two countries. And obviously Romanians have been very keen to stress that the mechanism has played an important role in these developments. It's important to stress the fact that the mechanism has changed significantly over time as well. I decided not to put too many slides with the revised conditions that the Commission has prepared on a regular basis, but in the latest reports, if you fancy reading them, you can see that there are 15 much more precise conditions set up for Romania, and there are 20 for Bulgaria. And I mean, again, it's a little bit sad that in the case of Bulgaria, we can see it's fascinating when the Commission's reference itself. So they say, as we've mentioned in the previous reports, so the observations made in the last report are still very relevant today. So they have, and importantly, in the case of Romania, as I've mentioned before, that included a completely different area and set of benchmarks and questions. Another important key difference that we can see after 9 years is that there is a significant gap emerging between Bulgaria and Romania. And I mean, again, it's fascinating to see that the impact of the mechanism is still widely contested. What I think it's important is that last year in April, it was the first substantial debate in the European Parliament. You would have expected they would enjoy the same scrutiny as the enlargement progress reports, but because of the sensitivity of this issue, it only happened last year. Importantly, there was very little debate about the effectiveness of the mechanism or the future of the mechanism, but rather the questions were focusing more on why should this mechanism be still in place. It's interesting to mention also as well that the debate was actually in the budgetary committee of the European Parliament. So they try to make a link that this is important because of management of EU money, so hence we have it in the budgetary committee. Individual parties have not come with any particular strong lines on this mechanism. Another interesting development which we have seen is that for the first time with the new Commission, we have the first Vice President of the European Commission, and he's responsible for the rule of law. So therefore, he was the one who congratulated Romanians on their success of reform, and he was positive that similar developments will hopefully take place in Bulgaria, and mentioned 2016 as a key year to see decisive progress take place. The fact that there is a commitment to end the mechanism by 2019 is also a very interesting one. I would like to remind you that Bulgaria will be in charge of the presidency of the European Union in 2018, and I believe that Romania is to be holding the presidency of the European Council in 2019. So this is also another interesting dimension when trying to think and evaluate the situation. And I mean, again, as I have mentioned before, that we have Croatia joined much later. No similar scrutiny has been applied to Croatia. There is another very important dimension that we can see to this mechanism is that it has inspired the emergence of other instruments at EU level. First of all, we have the new approach to the accession negotiations that was agreed and that have put firmly the rule of law at the heart of the accession process. We have now basically this balance clause, which means that the first chapters to be open and to be dealt, which should be chapters 23 and 24. Essentially, they deal with fundamental rights and freedom, liberty, and security. The Commission has decided that lack of sufficient progress will not only hold the accession the negotiations on those two chapters, but hold the whole accession process. So these are important steps that have taken place. And as Adam mentioned last week, it has trickled down even to potential candidate countries. So even before accession negotiations have been opened, there is a strong focus and scrutiny on the fundamentals first approach. At the same time, the European Commission also managed to launch the EU Justice Scoreboard and publish reports on the effectiveness of judiciary systems. We can see that some countries have refused to provide data because they consider that it's not the responsibility or the job of the Commission to be looking into or evaluating this data. Similarly, the European Commission managed to launch the EU Anti-Corruption Report. It's important to know that they register some of the key problems that have emerged. They do not provide a ranking of different countries. As you can imagine, it's a particularly sensitive issue. And last but not least, we have seen the emergence of the rule of law mechanism. Probably it's a little bit of a stretch, but we can say that we have now the EU rule of law framework. And if you have been following the developments in Poland, we can see that this is the EU rule of law framework that the Commission is trying to use for the very first time. Needless to say, it is inspired by the CVM, but its development was pushed forward by developments in Hungary and the need to have a mechanism that is applicable to all member states, because in 2012 the Commission had the CVM and could scrutinize and exert quite a lot of pressure in the case of Romania, but it didn't have anything, it didn't know how to do with Romania. So it's very interesting to see whether this framework will be strengthened further or it will be diluted, because member states are not too keen to see the same level of scrutiny apply to all of them. And very briefly, I would just a few brief notes to conclude. Obviously, it's very clear and apparent that after accession, the leverage of the European Union diminishes significantly. So the new developments in terms of enlargement policy focusing on the fundamental rights and judiciary rightfully justified. It's also important, again, to reiterate the fact that such reforms take quite a lot of time, so we should not expect quick results. The growing gap between Bulgaria and Romania, I think that this is quite a significant development. It demonstrates that the European Union can play an important role in driving change. However, in order to properly understand the difference, the variation of the EU's impact, we should focus and look more into domestic factors. So this is something that I would like to do, and I'm keen on to evaluate and to work more, to do more work in Bulgaria and Romania before I come up with a more developed conceptual approach. It's clear that domestic actors are incredibly important, and the EU is an intervening factor in shaping change after accession. Nevertheless, it's an important one. And also, last but not least, the recent developments that we have seen, I mean, again, it's not only Bulgaria or Romania, we have seen similar developments in Poland, in Hungary. Greece is another example where I'm interested to look at, and I mean, again, we have Greece and Italy having similar problems. So how the EU is going to further develop and enhance its approach in terms of democratic governance is another interesting development to follow. At this note, I will stop.
Okay. Thank you, Ellie. I just remember the audience can testify that I kind of tell my students that the verification mechanism is such a small thing, concerns only two countries, that I didn't manage to get the things together and stuff. But I think your presentation really showed how much all the dimensions of the issues that are concerned, and how much they relate also to contemporary things. I was thinking Greece, but obviously the main issues are Hungary, Poland, and who knows what comes next in that regard. Okay, I have many questions, but I'd like to open to the floor first.
Yes, let me first of all thank you for your excellent presentation. I have three questions, all of which look ahead to your future research. So perhaps they're a bit premature, but I'll be interested to see how your thinking is developing on those questions. The first question is, what can explain the growing gap between Bulgaria and Romania? Clearly, the explanation has to lie in domestic actors. So the question is, how is it that the CVM has connected with domestic actors in Romania, but has not done so in Bulgaria? The second question is whether, when thinking of domestic actors, you consider that institutions such as the Anti-Corruption Directorate in Romania or political parties are likely to be more important in shaping the country's response to the CVM. Clearly, there is an interaction between the two, but I wonder whether you have any sense of whether we should be looking towards state agencies or political parties as the drivers of change. The third question is, how do you see the future of the CVM? In particular, given the commitment to end the CVM in 2019, is it likely that the CVM will become a lame duck in the next 3 years? Or do you think that something might replace it once it's discontinued?
Okay, answer these three questions, so we take three questions at a time.
I think that, I mean, again, the institutions have played a very important role, institutions building in the case of Romania, because we can see that members of different political parties have been trying to interfere with the work of both the Anti-Corruption Agency and the Integrity Agency. Another thing that we sort of forget about is that those institutions were set up in 2008. In the period between 2005 and 2008. So it took a little bit of time, and after that they managed to produce results. Another thing that I also wanted to mention is that the chief director of the Anti-Corruption Agency, confused the acronyms, she was also elected the European of the Year by Reader's Digest. So you can see that since she has taken office in 2013, the track record of this agency has been quite impressive. However, I don't think that institutions and building institutions can give us the whole story, because we can see that this didn't work in Bulgaria. I mean, I have lost track of how many different agencies and institutions were trying to be set up in place. With the Borkor is the only one that I can remember, but I'm sure that they have different variations. But all of them were just institutions on paper. I think that the Borkor, which is abbreviation for Fight Corruption, it's a very catchy name. Basically, they have published one strategy, but I haven't seen anything else. So, and they have restructured a few times the agencies that have been responsible for dealing with corruption and organized crime. And now we, for the first time, have a debate whether we should create and do what Romanians did and have an independent agency that is completely detached and independent in order to be given the powers to prosecute the developments in the country. But I mean, again, you can see that Bulgarians have been very creative with any different measures. We were talking, I think, with Vasilis and with Spiros before that, in order to make sure that cases in the court were allocated on random basis, there was an IT software installed in place. They managed to rig it. So the idea is that as long as they're not given independence, you can create as many institutions as you want, but we can see that in one case they do produce results and manage to fight off interference. The other thing we should remember, which I think is also very indicative and important, what happened in Romania, very unfortunate, the fire that took place in the discotheque in Bucharest. We have seen mass spread demonstrations against corruption. So the civil society there is much more active compared to civil society in Bulgaria. So I think that this is another part of the story which can contribute and explain why we have seen that the fight against corruption has been more successful in Romania, much more successful compared to Bulgaria. So those are some of the variables that I would like to look to and examine more. This is the relevance of domestic actors. I don't think that, I mean, again, the parties we have had parties in Romania and in Bulgaria being elected on anti-corruption ticket and have done very little to do so. Even the latest Romanian president has not done too much in order to establish his anti-corruption credentials. But nevertheless, you could argue that even if they do not interfere with the work of the institutions, this allows them to be more effective and more successful. The future is a very interesting it's a very interesting one. I mean, again, even if you think about it, in Bulgaria they regularly publish reports that Romania is going to get off this mechanism, so it's only going to be Bulgaria. I haven't heard this sort of narrative come from any of the European institutions. When did I last go? It was the end of 2014. Romanians have not heard about this development of different tracks. And they were very proud, actually, of the track record that the institutions have achieved in that matter. So it's very, very interesting to see. I can tell you that Netherlands will be firmly opposed to discontinuing this mechanism unless there is something else that is going to replace it. I think that the only thing that is getting slightly in the way of more concrete developments in that area is the migrant crisis, which has taken the attention away. And I mean, again, now in these days we have also the UK renegotiating with the European Union, so those are the key issues in the agenda. The promising thing is that we have a Dutch presidency now. So they said that in May, I think, that they're having a big debate about the rule of law, so they will try to make sure that this mechanism is strengthened significantly. So they have this as one of the priorities of their presidency, but to what extent they will be able to push it, we'll see. Hopefully they will come up with a more thorough vision.
Next question. Dan.
Yeah, thanks for the very eloquent presentation. I wanted to try and broaden it out a little bit, because you talked about what was done in 2000, well, in the run-up to accession, mm-hmm. and the possibilities that existed, at least for the first year, to postpone, and yet nothing was postponed, one went ahead. And you actually coincided with the sort of views that, you know, there was a mission that was to be achieved, there was an ambition to sort of get these countries in, and to some extent one was going to not look at what was really going on, or perhaps one was going to turn a blind eye or play down. And this sort of rather reminded me, this kind of hubris rather reminded me of what had happened with the development of the single currency, and rather similar lack of willingness to investigate what was really going on and to actually say, no, you are not fit to be a member of this particular part of the community. We should really say stop. And that took me to the thing which you said at the end, which was that leverage diminishes once succession has come. Once you've got somebody, it's very difficult to do something about their behaviour once they're there. But to some extent, the Eurozone crisis contradicts that, because there was a system where they had got them in, and in fact leverage then did increase, and an enormous amount of pressure was exercised on recalcitrant, or what were deemed to be recalcitrant, members of that community. And then you also kind of finished up by pointing to the case of Poland and Hungary. So here we're moving back from the question of economics and economic performance and economic behaviour, and responsible economic behaviour, to responsible rule of law behaviour. So that again we actually see the screws actually being tightened, or potentially tightened, on people who are already members of the club. So do you agree with the parallel that I'm drawing, and do you in fact see perhaps a further tightening, and do you see the case of Poland and Hungary as possibly leading to somewhere rather than leading to nowhere?
A simple question.
You always give simple questions.
Yes.
I will start with a little bit of context for Poland and Hungary, why they're interesting, and after that I will go back to the key differences in economic dimensions and in the rule of law dimensions. We can see, and many have argued, that what the European Commission did was not fair, because it never acted in a similar manner in the case of Hungary, but because the Hungarian ruling party now is not from one of the three main European parties, that was why they felt that it was not a big problem to go and scrutinize them in that particular manner, because we have that the Polish one is the law, no, it's rule and law, law and justice,
yeah,
law and justice. So they're with the conservatives, which are the so they're not one of the three main parties, and they say hence the reason why we have seen so much scrutiny and pressure put on Poland. We haven't seen any of those developments in the case of Hungary, so because Orban was not from one of the smaller parties but one of the mainstream political European parties. I think that the bigger difference and the bigger issue we can see is, I mean, again, the level of integration compared in economic levels, so how advanced, and the fact that we have the single currency there, are much more advanced compared to the European integration in terms of rule of law, and the fact that we have so many fragmented mechanisms that just come up illustrates the fact. I mean, the other problem that we have is that the only sanction that the European Union has at this point of time is the nuclear option of Article 7. So we do not have anything in between. So we have either we will scrutinize and investigate, say, in letters. And I mean, again, this was also the option that was considered in the Romanian political crisis in 2012. They say, well, there is nothing else that we can do. We have the nuclear option. And the problem with those mechanisms is because we haven't deepened we have deepened economic integration, but we haven't deepened the democratic governance or democratic reforms in the European Union to such level and to such extent, because member states are opposed to that idea. I mean, again, the rule of law mechanism that was envisaged to be a mechanism was diluted to a framework for dialogue by member states. So that was a decision that was made. So there is no appetite to be scrutinized and audited and evaluated by an independent European Commission in those areas. Hence the reason why when we have some sort of problem that comes up, they say, well, this is not the job of the European Commission. This is not part of any hard law at European level. So you don't have the competency and the responsibility to go and invest that. And I think that this essentially explains the difference that we have when we compare economic integration and let's say the the vision for deepening of democratic governance of the European Union. ALDE have tried to propose a very detailed program, and they say that democratic governance should come first, economic governance should come second, because we are a union that is based on the rule of law, and if you do not respect the rule of law, you cannot enforce any of the agreements that you have made in terms of economic integration. Hence, it's more important to deepen integration in this area. But at this point of time, I think it's probably going to be baby steps. I don't see any substantial reforms in those areas in the near future, given what the EU already has on its plate at the minute.
Brexit is also a nuclear option.
What?
Brexit is also a nuclear option, and that button is also on the to press.
Can I put in a question of my own? So I have a mini theory, so to speak, that in a way these mechanisms and the monitoring processes create, you know, sort of help enlarge the problem that they're trying to resolve for two reasons. One, because they create a constituency which benefits even directly from it, so, you know, you get a job in, you know, sort of dealing with the verification mechanism, so you don't want it to end because you may lose your job, but also indirectly, you know, it is if you want an industry, and I'm thinking also of the Western Balkans, how there is an industry, you know, accession negotiations is quite a big business in the Western, or pre-accession negotiations in the Western Balkans, so, you know, you would think that many people think, what would we do without, you know, pre-accession and then accession negotiation. So one is sort of creating a group of people who directly or indirectly benefit from that, and they want to maintain it as a process, you know, the odd trip to Brussels and nice things about that. The other thing is that it actually sort of, at a more ideational level, it changes the framing of the problem. So you would think that if there was no cooperation verification mechanism, the problem of corruption in Bulgaria would be a political and economic problem of the country in relation to performance in the European Union, globally, you know, how the economy or the country fares, you know, competitiveness and so in different rankings. Whereas now it is a problem of EU negotiations. Yeah, you have to balance the external power, you know, is it hegemonic, is there too much intrusion into domestic politics? And it changes the nature of the problem, yeah? It is not a problem of, you know, how can I make my performance better? It is more of a problem of how do I manage my relations with my supranational other parts. And I wonder whether this comes at all in your... any of this is verified from your knowledge of the topic, or I'm just sort of imagining things too much.
I think that maybe this might be more applicable in the case of the Western Balkans, because we've mentioned that, I mean, again, we should keep in mind that this is the first time that the European Union has tried to, I mean, before that, understandably, that was the most difficult issue, the last issue to be dealt with, but we also need to remember that the European legislation in that level was very, very thin, and that's why we can see a significant difference in the way that the 10 countries that joined in 2004 negotiated Chapter 24 compared to Bulgaria and Romania, who later negotiated Chapter 24. We can see, and I was told from officials who were working in Justice, Liberty and Security, it was called back then, that basically they said that they were sent information, that the information was verified in Brussels. There were no field trips to any of the 10 countries that joined in 2004. In the case of Bulgaria and Romania, field trips were made from Brussels to Bulgaria and Romania every 3 months. And they will go not only to Sofia, they will go to all the courts in the country, they will go to the border, go and interview truck drivers, whether they will ask for bribes or not. So there was a much more thorough investigation and examination on the behalf of the European Commission and Brussels, and I believe that they have a much better understanding of the developments in both Bulgaria and Romania. There were problems in the 10 countries that joined in 2004. I mean, there were problems in Poland as well, Poland was the issue that they were told to drop off, not Bulgaria and Romania. Bulgaria and Romania was open, so they knew that there will be problems, and it was much easier to continue to monitor rather than say, we will postpone by 1 year. So for 1 year, you just sit down, wait, do nothing, and you join 1 year later. So the idea was that by inventing this mechanism, they will make it more difficult for them to sit down and do nothing. So I think that another thing that is quite unique about the mechanism, and I think it's incredibly important, when we imagine Turkey trying to negotiate those issues, Bulgaria and Romania have given access to all the information, and what the European Commission knows is much more than what you can read in these reports. I mean, you have these reports, you have the technical updates that are much more interesting, but this doesn't mean that this is everything that the Commission knows. They have accumulated an unprecedented knowledge and understanding of what's happening in those two countries, unlike any of the other countries of the European Union. So I think that this is a unique opportunity and chance to use this knowledge and to turn it into something more efficient and more successful for the Western Balkans, but also for the other member states. I think that the framework of narrative is incredibly important to understand the differences for the performance in Bulgaria and Romania. I think that this is very interesting, because in Romania we can see that there is ownership of this process, the way that you can see. I mean, again, McCulvey, when she talks about it, or that there is they're proud of the achievements. They say, we don't do that for the sake of the European Union. We do it because we want this to be clean up. We want to improve things. We want a clean and a fresh start. In Bulgaria, you can see that, I mean, again, Bulgarians, they've always been very quiet. Of course, we will do it. We will do it. We will do it. And they say, we are experts on paper, so we have to write another. Well, of course, we will write another strategy. Yes, of course, we will write. What happened is the European Council in December, the Bulgarian Prime Minister turned up and said that he's happy to have more help from the European Commission, and he would like to invite European experts to come to Sofia and to deal with this issue, and he's not ashamed to ask for help. And then they said, who have you discussed this strategy with? So it just came to me right now. I mean, I just came up with that idea, so this is why I'm telling you. It's funnily enough, it's in the report. So basically what they're trying to do is to use it to verify an external audit of the judiciary. Whether this is going to happen or not is very interesting to see. But I think that that's the key difference of how you frame the problem demonstrates why in one case we have, and I mean again, Bulgarian MEPs during the first parliamentary discussion in the budgetary committee, all of them said it's just discriminatory, it doesn't work, we should discontinue it, if corruption is a problem in all the member states, why? So all the talk that was going on was how to get rid of it, rather than how to make it work. While in the case of Romania, as we can see, we are proud of this achievement, this is what we have done, this is our problem, we want to deal with it. So ownership of how the Romanians have managed to establish ownership of this issue and deal with it, I think is one of the key variables into understanding this puzzle of the variation of the impact of the mechanism. And I think it will be key to understanding the impact of the European Union on the Western Balkans, if it's to be successful. So that's why I think it gives an excellent case study to open up this box and try to think, what is it that drives ownership and domestic change? Obviously, the Commission has provided very useful templates in the case of Romania, which were not there in the case of Bulgaria. Well, they were not pushed so much and were given freedom how to go about it. But, I mean, again, there was no vision to see this through. So, yeah, I think it's a very interesting narrative, and it's very interesting to be explained further.
Thanks.
Will. Really interesting from a comparative point of view to try to explain the differences, obviously, and as the colleague over there said, it's probably in the domestic actors you want to look, and you just talked about ownership and so on as a possible explanation, but in your talk, the thing that came over to me was the difference in the fact that Romania has an independent judiciary and Bulgaria, although you didn't really say it, doesn't have that, and that seems to be a key distinction. And therefore the question is, what is behind the independence of the judiciary or not? And in the political science literature, they discuss this issue, and one of the theories I come across is that it's very much to do with the sort of the political system, the degree of competition within the political system, and the degrees to which that, you have a sort of consolidated democracy. and because if you have a political competition, then it's not in the interest of any one political party to impose upon the judiciary to put away the independence of the judiciary, because when they lose the election, then they're going to be in the position of being at the receiving end of any corruption trials or so on. And, you know, so the alternating factor in politics is something which preserves the independence of the judiciary, whereas if you don't have that, then you haven't got that same incentive to preserve the independence of the judiciary. Now, I mean, I don't really know if that's at all applicable in these two cases. Is it the case that Romania has a more consolidated democracy or a more competitive political system than Bulgaria that might explain it?
I think that this is a very important point as well, to look at the key differences. I haven't looked into detail in the case of Romania, but I think that this could be also another important key variable to look and concentrate at. I mean, it's clear that in the case of Bulgaria, judiciary has been used, because the big, well, what failed recently was, for the first time, there was a discussion about trying to reform the Supreme Judicial Council, which controls all the appointments, basically monitors all the procedures that has been put in place. So basically that was for the first time there was a new Minister of Justice who came from the NGO sector, had a clear vision, has been coming up with different proposals how to reform the Supreme Judicial Council. What happened is, although the ruling coalition agree in principle, there was a need for a constitutional reform. So 2 weeks before the Prime Minister said that he would like to ask for European experts to come and deal with the issue, essentially what happened is that they voted against those. So an attempt to try to reform and to make sure that the Supreme Judicial Council is independent was essentially killed 2 weeks before that. And the question is that clearly it has become apparent that even though we have different political parties, there is some sort of free and fair election. The problem is that there is quite a lot of concentration in power and influence. What happened is the configuration in the current government, in December, it was the Boyko Borisov, the GERB, the center-right, whatever they call themselves these days, and we have a joined forces from four different parties, I think it was, so essentially had five parties in a ruling coalition. Only one out of those five voted for changes that have been initially agreed in the summer. And I haven't followed, but I think that the other thing which might explain the difference is that probably the judiciary was more independent in the first place. I think that the starting point is also important, so that will be another thing that I will try to struggle with a little bit more, because I believe that generally Romania was not as bad as Bulgaria in the first place, which can account for the steadier improvements that we can observe and the significant success that they have managed to achieve. But clearly a very important variable, and I would like to look more into it.
Other questions? Well, let's come back.
Will's point about political parties is interesting, because you then can look at what's going on in Poland and Hungary, where contesting political parties actually entrench themselves and then can reconstruct how judicial appointments are made or set things into constitution. I wanted to ask, actually, again to take it into the Western Balkan area. Tamer and I were in Belgrade last week, I think it was last week, where they were terribly pleased and regarded themselves and said, we are the poster child of accession for 2020, is what they were looking for. Is this same rule of law imperative being set for this, which is presumably the next, or it's going to be the next member country? And do you actually see this in that country as a potential impediment? Will the poster child continue to be the poster child, and are we scraping beneath the surface and finding similar things in Serbia that, you know, we didn't want to talk about in Bulgaria, or we didn't want to talk about in Romania?
Adam has, I haven't myself looked into particularly developments in Serbia, but what I have noticed, I mean, I have followed the development of the European Commission approach towards enlargement, and in the case of Serbia, we have not one, but two disbalance clauses, which means that, I mean, again, Serbia opened accession negotiations, so we have these two chapters. And I mean, the other interesting thing is in the case of Bulgaria and Romania, there was only one, chapter 24. In the case of Croatia, we already had chapter 22 and 24 created, and many have been talking about confusion, because essentially what the Commission did is put the political criteria that candidate countries need to meet in order to open accession negotiations. The understanding was that we need to continue and keep monitoring the political criteria during the accessions in case there are some not so good developments. So what has happened is not only do we have two chapters, and I mean, again, the idea even back then with Croatia was to open those difficult chapters first, because the European Commission has learned a lesson that in 12 months you cannot expect, or in such a short period of time, you cannot expect swift developments. And what we have seen now with the new approach towards the accession negotiations from the Western Balkans, so in Montenegro there was only one disbalance clause, which is if there isn't sufficient progress in terms of chapters 22 and 24, accession negotiations halt. In the case of Serbia, we have, if there isn't sufficient progress in chapter 23 and 24, and chapter 35, which is the dialogue with Pristina. So not only those areas, but on top of that, Kosovo will be the key elements that the Commission will keep monitoring very closely to see that they will determine the speed of the advancement of the accession negotiations. And many in Serbia have said that this is not particularly fair to raise such high standards and demand and do things that previously have not been done in the accession history. So it's interesting to see, but there is quite a lot of scrutiny on the countries from the Western Balkans. To what extent it's going to be productive or counterproductive, I think that we shall see soon.
Turkey and Cyprus as well.
Can I add to that? Sorry, is there a question?
Yeah. Thank you for the great presentation. Although I'm Bulgarian, I feel a little bit depressed after that. You mentioned that in Bulgarian institutions were built to fight corruption, but can the lack of progress be related to the lack of expertise in these institutions? Or it's
I don't think that this is an excuse for the lack of progress, because basically what has happened before that, there were certain ideas that the European Commission will suggest, because it will, we will say we'll have the expertise, so we'll have some ideas in order to how to set up some of the developments in the country. And what happens is, like, you have one proposal and it gets all watered down by the time that it reaches Parliament and goes to So I don't think that it's I think that it's lack of political will, and I think that there are so many examples that demonstrate that lack of political will to sabotage otherwise perfectly working instruments and arrangements. I mean, this is the easiest example for me to remember. How can you rig an IT system that is supposed to randomize the selections of judicial allocation of court selections? But there is always a way to do things. So, yeah, I don't think it's the lack of expertise.
Can I just follow up with another question? On the, you mentioned a few times about sort of the, you know, kind of the enforcement, kind of the question, ability of the European Union to influence policy, but we didn't. In a way, there's a bit of a paradox. On, you know, if you look at Romania, how are they? You know, to the extent that they're doing very well, how they're doing very well, given that you've lost the carrot and the whole thing about sort of accession conditionality. So what achieves compliance and better enforcement in one place than another place? And I guess this is the transferable question also for whatever, Hungary, Greece, and everybody else. And I think the literature in the Western Balkans have moved a bit beyond the kind of incentives, rewards, penalties kind of debate, and got a bit deeper into the idea of interest alignment and how do you, you know, not thinking of countries, but specific actors or constituencies within countries, how do you achieve a process which aligns interests in a way that it's win-win, you know, to their interest to support a specific process.
Mm-hmm.
And then I can think also from the previous, what you're saying about Romania earlier, that, you know, this somehow happened in Romania much more perhaps than in Bulgaria. So domestic actors,
mm-hmm.
and things like that. But I wondered if there is something to be learned from the mechanism at large beyond interest alignment, and say, okay, you know, to what extent we have a change in the incentives, the sense of rewards, and to what extent there's a process of learning, to what extent there's a process of shaming, you know, sort of this kind of cultivated responsibility for not being always pointed out as the underperformer. If there's something bigger to be learned on the whole issue of compliance, conditionality and compliance, from the verification mechanism, as we are learning now things about from the Western Balkans, but from the new approaches.
Mm-hmm.
So if you were to say, what is the verification mechanism taught us about compliance beyond what we knew from, you know, kind of the simulfending literature,
mm-hmm.
and stuff. What are the mechanisms where it works, besides the fact that, you know, some countries are more aligned than others, and, you know, domestic actors are more supportive than other places?
Doesn't this come back to the point at which we had earlier about, you know, how much leverage do you have once you've actually decided you're going to let them in? And if there is a commitment to let them in, this is why I ask about Serbia and what's happened, but it's why I also drew the parallels with the Eurozone. It's also why that it actually becomes very difficult. That, you know, you can monitor things, you can tick boxes, you know, more complex box ticking procedures, and in a sense you went through more complex box ticking procedures. But in the end, you are still in the situation where very uncompliant Bulgaria is still sitting there, and very uncompliant Bulgaria is going to be run the presidency just at the critical time. And it's terribly difficult to draw back from something like this. A lot of these things do look like they are these nuclear options which you talked about, and the willingness to press nuclear buttons, either in economic governance or in law and order governance, is perhaps very, very very, very small. And that's actually to do with the kind of hubris which says, you know, kind of, we cannot admit that we made a fundamental mistake in going down this way. We are committed to doing this thing. We are locked into this process. And I find it very discouraging, which is why I find the case of Hungary discouraging, which is why I find the case of Poland discouraging as well. And precisely locking in on via the constitution, you know, you can actually do that.
But then, Bernard, what you say has a determinism, yeah? That, okay, once you're in the European Union, countries remain the same. And so Hungary is not as institutionally, in terms of whatever civil society, not as a quality country as the Czech Republic. And nobody can do anything about it.
That's what I was saying in Belgrade on the television.
Yeah.
And I actually said, you know, what the hell is this
okay,
which
so,
you really want to join? And is it actually a very functional thing at all? I think it's deeply dysfunctional. And I'm not poking fingers particularly at country A or country B, because we could poke fingers at people not very far from here. With, you know, kind of equal enthusiasm.
We know what
and
you'll be voting for in the referendum,
you know,
but in June.
We,
but
we know about despicable behaviour here. And,
okay.
It's interesting.
Any thoughts on this?
Right. I think that the two things that have been learned are slightly, well, one of them aligns with the knowledge that we already have from the literature, and essentially is that in order to have success, you need to make sure that you push for reforms before accession.
Yeah.
I think that that's common wisdom. I think that the other thing that is also very important, we can see that the European Commission is trying now to come with indicators how to measure sustainable track record. I think that this is key to understanding why change is going to be irreversible or not. We talk about the irreversibility of reforms. which was also mentioned in the case of Bulgaria and Romania, but I think that the Bulgarian and Romanians, I think that the European Commission was slightly naive about approaching those very serious issues, expecting to have quick results in 6 months. I think that that was the reason why you have the monitoring mechanisms every 6 months, because the idea was that they were eager and agog with anticipation to go and have some results to be ticked in 6 months. And I mean, even in ideal case situation, you wouldn't have expected these developments, even the development of a comprehensive strategy and the implementation of that strategy, to happen over the course of 3 or 4 years. So I think that this is another very important lesson that has been learned, that sustainable, irreversible reform takes time. And I think that the other focus is, I can tell you that when the first Boyko Borisov cabinet took place in 2009, everybody was so enthusiastic in Brussels about him. He said, yes, he will come and everything will be fine. We know this guy. He's a very good guy. He has strong commitments. So I am not entirely convinced that alignments of interests along party lines in Bulgarian case has not produced the desired result. So I think that that's why there is a very strong focus on making sure that they're independent, well, the judiciary is independent, we have independent integrity institutions. But I think that the other thing that the European Commission has done, and I think it's quite successful, more successful in Romania than in Bulgaria, is just to raise the profile of those issues and to try and to center the whole debate about other policies based on the need to urgently deal with those issues. You can see in the last report from 2015, in the case of Bulgaria, it says it's just not about the independency of the judiciary or fight against organized corruption. It's about the sustainability of the economy, and it's about everyday life of Bulgarian citizens, so they cannot enjoy the full benefits of their European membership unless they have their basic rights guaranteed and protected. So I think that it has helped significantly, and in Romania we can see how successful the civil society has been into creating, well, I don't know, maybe just raising the profile of those issues and making them the most important issue on the political agendas that need to be dealt with. And I'm hoping, but maybe it will take a little bit longer in Bulgaria, because there is probably 5-10% critical mass that is very engaged into following those issues and to pressuring institutions to complying with good standards and practices. And I mean, again, as you can see from the 45 cases against Bulgaria in the European Court of Human Rights, he will have to learn, so one way or another. So I think that this has been also slightly neglected. The idea of raising the profile of those issues has been also particularly important for igniting and engaging the civil society. Or at least I hope.
Okay, a lot of information, very, very interesting and useful insights. Eli, thank you very much for the presentation and the discussion. We may have you in a later time telling us, perhaps in the Hellenic Observatory seminar, telling us about the conditionality in Greece and the task force there, and then we can draw comparisons also. Bernard would be very happy to hear about that. Okay. Let me remind you again that our next event is on Tuesday, 16th of February. Fiscal decentralization and local government financing in Serbia and Montenegro. Same room here. Thank you all for coming, and please join me in thanking Eli Katova for this.